Capital Investment Committee for March 24th is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance to House Rule 10.01 and is being live streamed from the House Public Information Office. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Chair Lee.
Lee present.
Lee present. Vice Chair Murphy. Vice Chair Murphy. Representative Erdahl.
Present.
Erdahl present. Representative Igbaje?
Present.
Igbaje present. Representative Berg?
Present.
Berg present. Representative Davids?
Davids present.
Davids present. Representative Frankie?
Frankie present.
Frankie present. Representative Freiberg?
Present.
Freiberg present. Representative Hansen?
Hansen present.
Hansen present. Representative Hewitt?
Present.
Hewitt present. Representative Lilly? Representative Lilly. Representative Lucero.
Lucero present.
Lucero present. Representative Moran.
Present.
Moran present. Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Pearson present. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Raleigh present. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Rasmussen present. Representative Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. Representative West.
Present.
West present. Representative Zhang. Representative Zhang. And Vice Chair Murphy.
Murphy present.
Murphy present. And Representative Lilly. All right, Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum. All right, thank you. That is a quorum, Mr. Chair.
A quorum is present. Chair Murphy, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday, March 22nd?
Sure. I move approval of the minutes for March 22nd as they were printed.
Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for Tuesday, March 22nd. Any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for Tuesday, March 22nd are approved. Members, today we will focus on climate and how that impacts our credit ratings as we, make decision on funding for critical infrastructure. We will hear several informational presentations from various perspectives on the impacts of extreme weather events and environmental risks to state credit ratings. I hope everyone read the State Line article included in your virtual packet and posted on the committee's webpage. Our final presentation will be from Dr. Richard Graves, the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, on integrating resiliency into state capital projects. We will begin with Mr. Peter Mueller from the Pew Charitable Trust. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Mueller. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you very much. My name is Peter Mueller with the Pew Charitable Trust. Get this started. Can you see the slides?
Yes, please proceed.
Excellent. Good morning, Chair Lee, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. Like I said, my name is Peter Mueller. I am a researcher with the Pew Charitable Trust. I work on state fiscal policy issues. Before joining Pew, I spent a number of years in meetings a lot like this as a legislative staffer in Tennessee, where I was the budget director there for the House of Representatives. Before I get started, I want to say how excited my colleagues and I at Pew were to get this invitation and speak to you on this particular topic. It's one we've been exploring for a while now. In addition to being here to share Pew's perspective, hearing what questions the members of this committee have and how you all are thinking about this issue will really help us shape our future work. So thank you for having us. I really appreciate it. I want to start off by telling you a little bit about Pew and how we approach our work on fiscal issues. Pew is a nonpartisan public charity that's dedicated to improving public policy through rigorous evidence-based research. And we touch on a whole number of different policy areas. With respect to our areas on state fiscal work, we approach our work with a research focus on long-term fiscal stability for states, which means we are always looking for ways to help states put structures and practices in place so that the budget choices you make today don't just help balance this year's budget, but also help set the table to ensure future budget decisions can be made from a position of strength. As a few examples, We've done a good deal of research into how states fund pension systems to avoid long-term structural imbalances, how they structure their rainy day funds to weather times of economic volatility. And most relevant to today's discussion, we have been looking at ways to identify emerging fiscal risks, including the ways that extreme weather events and natural disasters can impact fiscal stability. So with that introduction out of the way, I'll jump right in to why I'm here today, which is why I'd give all of you an overview of how these changing conditions are beginning to impact state bond ratings and how they impact state long-term fiscal health generally. First, let's quickly hit on what goes into these ratings. While each rating agency's methodology is unique, in general, they're going to care about things like the economic health of the state, the fiscal strength of your budget, institutional strength, like institutions like this legislature, and whatever debt and liabilities you've racked up. These ratings will look at both quantitative and qualitative factors. And then in recent years, there has been new attention on ESG, which stands for environmental, social, and governance factors. For today, we're mostly focusing on the E part of that, the environmental factors. Understanding ESG risks and impacts on credit quality, it's part of a larger effort to be more forward-looking and evaluating and quantifying risk. This stuff isn't brand new. It's not like analysts have long considered questions about if we're gonna fund this project that is built here, is it being built in a floodplain that's gonna affect it 10 years down the line? That's not a new concept. What is new is that rating agencies in recent years have focused more attention on these factors, and including driving more transparency and clarity about how they're working these environmental factors into their ratings. And they're releasing more supplemental research and commentary on how they're doing that. They've also taken steps to boost their capacity. So things like acquiring data analytics firms who specialize in modeling weather and disaster risks and things like that. So the next question is, why does all of this matter to you as state legislators? First bullet point here, I hope is pretty straightforward. If your credit rating is negatively affected because of these risks, means you're gonna increase the cost of borrowing. If you have to spend more money on interest, it's less for all your other priorities. You all have to make extremely difficult budget decisions every year with a limited pool of resources. More money towards interest is less for everything else that you care about and that your constituents care about. But aside from the impact on the cost of borrowing, these are also issues that you should pay attention to for the sake of your state's long-term fiscal health. The risk factors we're talking about here today, the things the rating agencies care about when deciding how creditworthy states are also the factors that just go into your state's ability to invest in its long-term needs. The same things that give you a better credit rating will also put you in a better position down the line to afford the things that your constituents need. All right, so now we'll get into some more tangible examples of the types of things that make up these environmental risk factors from the state budget context. I'm gonna break these into two categories, as they often get talked about, physical risks and transition risks. Physical risks are the more direct impacts to people and places and things like that, caused by natural disasters or long-term changes in weather. These can appear like short-term shocks, so damage from tornadoes or wildfires or floods. Or they can be longer-term trends, like damages caused if temperature is hotter over time all the time, that heat can cause sort of long-term damage to things. Or if you get more rainfall than you're used to, that additional precipitation can cause additional damage, those kind of longer-term trends. One way that these risks interact with state budgets directly is in increased costs related to disasters and emergency management. Emergency management costs have been increasing across the country and across all levels of government. To throw one set of numbers at you, if you look at FEMA's public assistance grant expenditures that they give out to states to support grants, if you compare the first decade to the second decade of the 2000s, those grew by over 23%. Just to give you an idea of how it's going up. In addition to being more expensive, these types of expenditures are really volatile. So maybe you only have a massive flood once every 10 years, but those other years, if you're not preparing for that expense in those other years, that one budget year can be a real challenge. Right now, the federal government plays a really significant role in assisting states for those high volatility events, which can help smooth it out and helps like, and it helps minimize your risk from this extreme volatility from a financial standpoint of these events. But I do want to note there has been, as the cost and frequency of these federal expenditures has gone up, there has been some conversation about what the federal role should be and if there are ways to reduce the federal cost in these types of circumstances with these disasters by shifting some of that responsibility back to the states. If that were to happen, states would be on the hook for more expenses and would have to find ways to deal with more of that volatility on their own. So just as you're thinking about potential things that could change going forward, that's one to keep on your radar. Another impact is the cost associated with assets and infrastructure. You've got your disaster shocks, your tornadoes, your hurricanes, fires, floods, et cetera, are gonna continue to damage state-owned structures at an increasing rate. And so that's obviously gonna mean more money for replacement, more money for repairs, maybe higher construction costs if you're gonna try to build things back in a stronger way so that they're less vulnerable the next time a disaster hits. But beyond those kind of replacement costs, also, you also have issues like longer term trends like heat and rainfall and in coastal areas, sea level rise that can really stress infrastructure. We've seen some evidence that in particularly transportation infrastructure is vulnerable for this sort of thing. Unfavorable conditions like more heat can expand pavement and help create potholes. Additional rainfall can, or weaken bridge joints. Rainfall can have, can work in conjunction with this and really make you have to repair and replace these things more often, which again, we're talking about more expense, which is another thing you have to plan for in the future. If you don't plan and pay for these additional maintenance needs up front, the deferred maintenance element can build up. States generally understand that with things like a pension fund, if you don't pay for it up front, eventually the bill comes due and it's gonna be a really big hit to your budget, a really big credit risk. The same is true with things like deferred maintenance. If these changing conditions mean that you have to pay more to keep your roads and other infrastructure up to date, if you don't pay for it as you go, it's going to eventually have to face a pretty significant bill that could be a problem. But that's a lot of doom and gloom. So let me at least throw a little positivity here. When we talk about the needs for assets and infrastructure, some of that can also be toward needs for spending for mitigation activities. The research we've done into spending on mitigation infrastructure things through federal disaster mitigation grants suggests that there is about a $6 savings for every $1 in disaster mitigation nationwide. We also saw the Minnesota specific number of that was $6.13 for every $1. So that is something to think about as well. All right, in addition to these direct physical risks, rating agencies also look at transition risks. This is more the risk created by societal disruptions associated with broader shifts in policies and behaviors and markets as we adjust to these extreme weather events and also related to the anticipated change that we're all making toward a lower carbon economy. These risks include things like economic disruptions. So some industries, some examples might be energy or tourism or agriculture, have greater vulnerability to the disaster, to these changes that we're talking about. Economic activity related to the production of oil, gas, or coal could be really greatly diminished if we see regulatory changes related to carbon emissions, or just consumer behavior that moves away from those sources of energy. Well, sustained increases in temperature could really cause disruptions in the agriculture sector if the current sets of crops have to be swapped out for others as heat increases. States that have heavy concentrations of these sorts of vulnerable industries, you could see a drop in revenue along with as the economic activity in those industries gets disrupted. And of course, a drop in revenue could negatively impact credit ratings as well. Another way these transition risks can impact is in shifts in population. So this can take form of relocations driven by a temporary disaster shock. One example of that, if you think back to 2005 when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, hundreds of thousands of people moved from New Orleans to other nearby cities because of the immediate impact of that hurricane. It can also take the form of longer, more persistent changes. If over time, average temperature, frequency, or economic changes make certain locations less desirable or even uninhabitable, then you would see populations start to shift from one area to another. Looking at all of this through the state budget perspective, if you have population leaving, that is taking a lot of economic activity and income with it, which again is something you have to think about for long-term planning and revenue. So now that we've hit on those risk factors, and those aren't the only ways you can think about those by any means, but just as some examples, the natural question is to ask, how and when will state rating agencies change because of these risks? I'm not in a position to say exactly, you know, five years, 3 months, and 2 days from now, you're going to, or anything like that. But it's something we're watching closely and very interested in. There is a lot of energy around this in the financial world, but states are also like big, complex entities with a lot of factors that go into their credit rating agencies. And this is one part of all of that. So I will really be interested to see when these environmental risks start registering as a large enough factor to start really moving the needle on state ratings. I mentioned earlier the role of federal financial support in shielding states from some of the biggest short-term shocks with natural disasters, but it's not just natural disasters that the federal government steps in here, provides a little support for economic crises. If you think back to the Great Recession, or most recently, the pandemic funding that massive amounts of federal additional aid flowed to states to help in a time of crisis. So one part of all of this question of when will these ratings start to matter is how strong will this federal commitment to help states in times of economic crisis, economic volatility remain? Because that really, if credit rating agencies view that as a stable thing, that can really help to enhance the view of state creditworthiness. If things go bad, the federal government's going to step in and help, so the lenders don't need to worry that their money is going to be at risk. If there starts to be concern that the federal government is moving away from that, that could accelerate when these risks really start to impact the state credit worthiness considerations. One development we followed over the years related to this, in 2020, FEMA proposed a rule that would have increased the damage threshold for disaster relief, which means that a disaster would have had to be would have to cause a higher dollar amount in damage before the federal money would start to flow into a state or local government. That one hasn't moved forward yet, but just as an example of the conversations at the federal level that may impact how the federal government is thinking about supporting states in these circumstances, and following that thread, how rating agencies will think about it going forward. I would also encourage you to think a little bit about local governments in your state with respect to these issues. Local governments tend to be smaller, they tend to be less geographically diverse, and have fewer resources to help them manage large fiscal shocks. So it's very possible that due to those factors, you might start seeing environmental risks showing up in the credit rating agencies of your cities, towns, counties, before they hit the state's credit rating. And so it was worth thinking about how you all want to, you know, what this is, there a state role in helping ensure that local governments continue to have access to the credit they need? Another way we're looking at this is we've been doing some tracking of how states have begun responding to these risks. I've included a couple of just sort of illustrative examples here. These are by no means the only thing states are doing or trying to capture the whole world of it, but wanted to give you some examples. North Carolina in 2020 published what they called a comprehensive climate risk assessment plan, where they tried to identify every possible way that climate risk could affect their state spending. And it covered lots and lots of things. It covered everything from increased road maintenance, as we've already discussed a little bit, to how changing conditions could impact a farm run by their state prison system and whether they would need to buy more food for the prison system as a result of that farm being disrupted. California did an exercise where they tried to look at their wildfire situation and did some simulations to look at what fires across the Sierra Nevada forests would look like all the way through 2029, so going out about 100 years. And they analyzed different potential mitigation approaches and how that would impact their wildfire situation. Maryland also took commissioned a study from more of an investor perspective where they looked at their public pension and looked at what they were investing their money in. And so they commissioned a study to look at how these climate-related factors were going to impact their investment returns for their pension plan, which is kind of taking this whole conversation and flipping it around and putting the state in the lender role rather than the borrower role. But that's an interesting way to think about how this affects your fiscal health as well. One more interesting example that didn't make it onto my slide, it comes from Colorado, where they have developed something called a Future Avoided Cost Explorer. It's something that the state created to kind of help local governments make decisions about how they're going to spend money on resilience actions, as they're referring to it. So this tool tries to estimate the current and future impacts of floods, of droughts, and of wildfires across all sorts of different sectors of Colorado's economy to help local governments think about, okay, if I spend money here to do some things to help minimize the impact of these disasters, what is the payoff going to be on that? Finally, I want to highlight a few developing issues sort of at the federal level that we're monitoring. There's been a lot of interest lately in questions about disclosures of these risks, disclosures of these environmental risks, disclosures of ESG risks in general. And this is actually really timely here. Just this past Monday, the SEC released a new proposed rule that would require companies to make more disclosures about carbon emissions and physical risks to their assets, and a number of other things as well, something like a 500-page proposed rule that I won't bore you by ticking through all of. The rule itself that was announced doesn't apply to municipal bonds, so it wouldn't apply to the bonds that you all are issuing. But it is an indicator of where the conversation is going when we're talking about disclosure of what these, all of these risks here, investors want to know what your potential risks are. And so it's a good indication of where that conversation is going. Tied into that, the MSRB, which does regulate the municipal bond market, has recently sent out a request for information asking different muni market participants, the lenders, the borrowers, and others as well, what kind of risks they currently disclose and what risks they want to see disclosed. So there is a lot of conversation about investors wanting to know how these issues are going to hit your bottom line as they're deciding whether to lend you money. As I'm wrapping up here, let me leave you with these thoughts. First, environmental risk is a space where we would say policy makers at all levels of government can benefit from careful, specific attempts to assess and analyze fiscal risk. Minnesota might not need to plan for hurricanes as much as Florida does, but you might want to think about how will increased flooding affect your communities? What public assets are at risk? What part of your economy might it disrupt? Are there populations at risk of displacement as a result? And on and on. Thinking through those issues now will help you plan for them going forward. Second, the analysis of environmental risk shouldn't happen in a vacuum. Trends in population growth or loss can affect your fiscal future if they're driven by environmental risks, like we've been talking about, but also they can affect your future if it's just lots of people moving to Minneapolis because they like watching the Twins play. So this should, the conversation about environmental risk should really build on the systems you already have in place for thinking about the future and thinking about how things are going to change and how those changes are going to affect your budget. This should be one variable in that conversation, as opposed to a whole separate standalone idea. And then finally, these attention to these risks has been really growing in recent years. State and local governments are starting to take action. This committee and holding this hearing, you all are not alone in thinking these things are important. So thank you for holding this. It's a really important step. We will be very interested to see how you and other states continue to work to manage these issues going forward. Thank you very much for your time, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Moeller. Members, we have about 9 minutes for questions for Mr. Moeller. If you have any questions, please let me know before we move on to the next presentation. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's a very stunning presentation on consequences. And I'm thinking of how we've dealt with disasters in Minnesota over the last 15 years. I remember the 07 Rushford floods, which was kind of the first massive rainfall event, and there have been several subsequent, and at the time we were dealing with special sessions to respond, so we've been responding, spending in terms of response. And, you know, I wonder if when we put this into an account, rather than responding with a special session, the phrase that there's nothing special about a special session, then climate action no longer was special. Somebody was just taking care of it by writing a check to cover the cost. And we don't see those costs because they're an account that just covered. And they keep growing, and we have to put more money into the account year after year, whether it's ice storms or flooding. But we don't have an account for mitigation. We don't have an account for prevention. We don't have those type of things with an equal thing because we put it into a programmatic response. And so we don't see it. We don't see that cost that we do when we had to respond in 07, 09, 011, 010. We think that we've solved it. And I wonder if one question is, are other states doing the same thing? I mean, if they just set up disaster funds that then cover the costs that aren't covered to public infrastructure, and therefore it's, we just keep increasing that spending. Or are states doing a climate resiliency fund to mitigate terror and to prevent these things? I guess there's a difference between clearing the trees out of the streets and the mud off the buildings and building the levees versus holding the water upstream or planting trees that are more resilient. There's things that could be done that are different. And we seem to be on that disaster response phase. And I'd like some comparison with what other states may be.
Mr. Moeller?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. We have done a lot of research into the different ways that states do approach disaster spending, and it does vary quite a bit. I think the point you're hitting on the difference between sort of the response spending, the you know, when things go bad, you got to spend the money to deal with it, but then all the pre-disaster, the mitigation, all of that, it is a big challenge because disaster becomes front of mind when it's a problem, and when it's a problem, you need to put the money toward responding to it, and that makes it hard to think about when you put it toward what to put toward mitigation. I have seen some states that have taken an approach of funding a disaster specific fund, and unused funds in any given year can be used for mitigation activities as one way of doing it. Other states will have recurring money in mitigation from year to year to year. I would be happy to share with the committee the report we've done that kind of details what different ways states are approaching this. That would be helpful as well.
Representative Hanson, any follow-up?
Thank you. I think that'd be helpful.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Mr. Mueller, for the presentation. I found it sobering to think about, especially when I thought about some of our key sectors in Minnesota, agriculture and tourism, for example, and thought about the statewide impact that climate change is having on those areas, and that also a hit on our financial well-being would have on our ability to cope with that. My hope is that for people who are very dollars and cents kind of people, that this is very attention getting for thinking about where we need to go. My question, that was a comment, my question is really about planning versus action. I've worked in large companies and organizations my whole career. I have seen many a plan put in place and little action to follow. And I'm wondering how the bonding organizations will be assessing whether or not
plans are being put into play when they are thinking about the ratings. Thank you.
Similar.
That is a really interesting question. Some of our other speakers are more in the bond market itself and speak more to how the agencies are thinking about that better than I can. So I'll defer on that one if that's all right.
Before we go, Ms. Wistrick, I know that you're going to be next, and so maybe you could cover that in your presentation. Mr. Mueller, Representative Wright, do you have any follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to just defer that question to the proper speaker. Thanks.
Okay, Mr. Mueller, last question for you then. Can you talk a little bit more about your bullet point where we're thinking that risk, you know, the environment risk might hit our local municipalities first before the state? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I would be happy to. A lot of the elements that I was a lot of the elements that make these environmental risks kind of tangible or material are going to show up a lot earlier at the local level. It seems likely. If you think about the amount of money available when a shock hits, if it affects a small part of the state, that part of the state will be really expensive to the town that it hits, but as a percentage of the overall state budget, that might be a much lower percentage hit to the overall needs. So the state can weather its additional expenses in that area, but if it's half of a town gets damaged by a flood, that is a much, much more catastrophic event on the town level budget. So you can see how if you were thinking about lending to that town, if a flood hits, it's much, the town's less likely to repay by itself than the state would be able to continue to repay. Things like economic concentration. If a small town might be more likely to be sort of a one industry town, and if that industry gets really disrupted by these factors, that might be a bigger impact percentage-wise to the town than to a state as a whole. So those are the kind of things we're thinking about these concerns might show up more for your locals and increase their cost of borrowing before it affects the state that has more resources and can better kind of spread that risk out.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller, for your presentation and for answering that questions. Really appreciate that. Next up, we have Ms. Wistrick from S&P Global Ratings. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, I'm Nora Wistrick. I am the ESG sector leader for our practice. So my role is really to drive analytical education for our teams around themes and emerging risks that materialize associated with environmental, social, and governance risks. I also am responsible for thought leadership and also talking with market participants around how S&P as one credit rating agency thinks about these risks, how we integrate it into our ratings, and also Representative Ryer, you know, how we talk to issuers about it on an annual basis. So I'm a credit ratings analyst. I have been in the market in a varying capacity for over 20 years. And before coming back to S&P as a rating analyst, I did also work for the state of Florida. So I understand what you guys are wrestling with on a regular basis, but I'll share my screen. I do have a couple of slides here that sort of more emphasize maybe some of the things that that Peter already talked about. But, you know, in terms of the way that we think about it, you know, we've always baked these risks into the credit rating analysis for states and for the entities we rate. And so we've always talked to states, we've always talked to issuers about how they're prioritizing their risks that they see for their organization, how they're funding them based on those priorities and that strategy, and how they're executing on them. To your point, Representative Ryer, once we sort of know something is happening and something's been prioritized, we will regularly check in with an entity about how they're progressing in terms of execution, or potentially under different administration or leadership priorities, how they get reprioritized. So we do know that different administrations, particularly at the state level and even at the federal level, can reprioritize certain policies and certain decisions. And it's not our role in the market to opine on whether or not we think the policies are correct. But we do want to, it is our role to opine on how we think those policies can help stabilize, you know, your economy or your budgetary metrics in light of how you implement them and execute on them. So, you know, I'll say that S&P Global believes that climate change is real. We believe that the, you know, incremental warming will lead to more costly and severe and frequent hurricanes and inland flooding. I think, you know, the state doesn't have a coastline like maybe other states do, but you guys probably are subject to a tremendous amount of inland flooding relative to the lakes and estuaries that you have in your state. So for us, we probably view chronic flooding, which also intensifies with global warming, to be probably the most material risk for the state rather than, you know, some other things like hurricanes or things like that. Sea level rise, you guys aren't probably having to deal with that directly. So Peter already kind of talked about this, but last year we adopted or we implemented, so I know you may not be intimately familiar with the way that bonds are rated in the municipal market, but each credit rating agency and S&P in particular has what we call a criteria. And within that criteria, and I'll go to the next slide, this slide might be the best. So within the criteria for US states, we look at a number of different components. We look at the government framework, which is really the state's relationship with the local governments, how they can help governments in times of fiscal distress, how the referendums, you know, if there's a lot of voter initiatives in the state and how that can affect your, you know, your ability to operate and manage your operations effectively. And so a lot of that gets captured into the government framework. And then, of course, for every entity that we evaluate, whether it's a government, whether it's a utility, whether it's a healthcare entity, we're always looking at financial management and some of the policies and practices that an entity has in place to, again, sort of take a forward-looking view of the risks. Peter mentioned how North Carolina had, I believe it was North Carolina, took like a comprehensive look, or maybe it was Maryland, on how climate change could affect all these different areas within their operations. And so we really are thinking about that, you know, from a financial perspective as well. So long-term financial planning, revenue estimates, how often do you review these revenue estimates? Are you incorporating like changes from the pandemic into future revenue estimates? Are you thinking about how, you know, physical risks could affect the state and how what that might mean for your capital plan or your long-term financial viability? But where we see an acute impact potentially on a state's credit profile is really in our economic analysis and in our budgetary performance analysis. And Peter kind of already alluded to this. So within our economic analysis, we're looking at many things, including the state's output, so your gross state product. We're looking at, you know, the job diversification relative to the U.S. We're looking at, you know, other types of trends that influence your ability to generate economic activity within your state. So whether that's population trends, age dependency trends, things like that, all of that sort of can get incorporated into our view of the state's economy. And one thing, as Peter pointed out, that can disrupt economy, and we believe it will disrupt economies, and to your point, Chairman Lee, more so sometimes at a local level rather than at the state level, is these acute influences from severe weather, from flooding, from wildfires. We know the state does suffer a little bit from wildfires in certain parts of the state. And also how these can impact, you know, water supply. So if you have pervasive drought conditions, what's happening in terms of water supply and alternate water supply options that would not stave off economic development? Because obviously, you know, if you don't have enough water to serve your community, how do you continue to attract people to your community? And then also the chronic risks from climate change, which are, you know, just those longer term prolonged things that can happen, like heat and cold waves, you know, very cold weather that occurred in Texas in 2021 that, you know, stayed for like 2 weeks. And having lived in Texas, it's never cold in Texas for like a prolonged period of time. It can be cold on a day and then the next day it's warm again. But that prolonged period of cold weather in Texas in 2021 that really led to a lot of social issues with people dying and things like that, and just the inability for utilities to operate within that particular cold weather period because they don't insulate their utilities like Minnesota and places in the Northeast do, you know, that we believe was in part driven by climate change. And so we think those incidences of sort of prolonged weather patterns are definitely driven by climate change. And then, of course, natural disasters, which we incorporate as like earthquakes and tornadoes. And those are only separated out because we think those things right now are not driven by climate. You know, those are really natural disasters. So your budgetary performance, you know, when these types of climate change issues occur and these risks happen, you know, can disrupt your ability to collect revenue. They can result in higher expenditures either in the short term before FEMA does come in and sort of help you guys to manage that response, or in the long term, whether you have to change the type of pavement that you're using in your roads to be more resilient, whether you have to repave your roads more frequently because ice and snow and things like that is happening with more prevalence than maybe it had in the past. So, you know, we really think that those are the two areas where state credit quality in particular can be very disrupted by climate and environmental risks. I think one of the representatives asked about what states are doing to sort of like insulate their budgetary performance long term. And I'll give you an example. I think Peter has great research on this that he'll circulate. But for example, Hawaii, which is, you know, a island, has dedicated a hurricane relief fund that they either fund on an annual basis or fund, you know, incrementally as they have surplus revenues to put in there. But that fund is specifically dedicated to manage their operations and insulate their operations should a high impact event occur. Other states like Louisiana and Florida have special insurance sponsored mechanisms that they've developed in response to their particular physical risks and their frequency of hurricanes that have happened over the course of time. Florida actually has two. They have citizens insurance, which stabilized the commercial insurance market after Hurricane Andrew. And then they have the Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, where the state can actually issue debt for liquidity purposes following an event. So those are some other ways that states have adapted to their particular physical risks. So we all capture this within what we call our sector-specific criteria. But the other thing that we did last year to help articulate how these risks can change either quickly or over time is we published an ESG and principles criteria. And some of these risks are ones that we've already talked about, but S&P Global applies these comprehensive risks across all of our ratings practices. And I think sometimes this is what confuses the market is the nomenclature. And so climate transition risk is really those risks relative to decarbonization, the transition in the economy relative to, you know, eliminating carbon intensive economic output, physical risks, I think we've covered. But also, you know, I know we're not talking about S&G, but, you know, we also believe that social capital, which is a government's interaction or an entity's interaction with its community, is, you know, intimately tied into credit quality. But the main thing that I wanted to point out on this slide is that we believe that the materiality and the direction or influence from a risk can change very abruptly. You know, whether it be secular change relative to decarbonization, or whether it be an acute change from a chronic flooding event, you know, those things can be very disruptive, and we may not have a lot of visibility necessarily into the risk until something like that happens. We also point out here in our principles criteria that these risks can be different depending upon the region or the sector in which you're, you know, working within. So for governments, and I think for state governments, because you guys have very broad tools in your toolbox, you have, you know, budgets that you primarily can, you know, manage in a way where you can move things around if something were to happen and you were need to allocate resources to it. That is something that local governments don't have the luxury of all of the time. You also have, you know, the risks being diffuse across your whole state rather than being more localized. So for now, you know, a lot of states, we recognize these risks as being fairly neutral, but as climate change accelerates, you know, they can change quickly, even for states. And then I think we just, for us, what we view as being very important is that because we've always baked these risks into our criteria, when they become material and visible is when they cross over into credit. So many times people ask us, well, you know, Nora, we're doing all these great things. Like, you know, we are, you know, implementing LEED certified building code standards. We're changing our fleet to, you know, electric vehicles rather than carbon-based engines. And all of that we find as being incredibly important, particularly to help stave off climate change in general. But typically, those sustainability efforts don't always sort of cross over into, you know, the way it gets a material part of the credit rating. So, you know, I think there's always sort of that conversation between sustainability and how it affects the credit rating. And sometimes they're meaningful and they intersect, and sometimes they're just sort of like, that's a great thing that you're doing, but we're not sure, you know, where it sort of impacts the credit rating, if you will. And then the last thing I'll say is that for us, you know, and some of the issues that Peter referenced in terms of transparency, I will say, and I know Matt Fabian is on the line and he can speak much more from an investor perspective than I can, but investors are keenly interested in how ESG risks affect credit quality. And so in response to that, we have tried to implement a number of different transparency efforts for Minnesota and for all states. And actually for a couple of years now, we've had a dedicated paragraph in our criteria, in our credit rating rationale that talks about the risks that we find to be material or influential for each entity specifically. And I think what we've pointed out for Minnesota is that while you do have physical risks that you have to deal with, like from, you know, incidences of drought and wildfire and flooding, you know, you guys have started to do some things to help manage that risk. And it is very important to us when we're talking about the risks to understand what techniques you're using to mitigate it. And I think, you know, all of that is important in terms of, you know, the credit rating overall. So I'll stop there. I do see at least one question, which I'm happy to answer. And Representative Ryer, I wanted to make sure that I addressed your question as well.
Thank you, Ms. Wistruck. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to decide if this question makes sense outside of my own head, but I was looking at your slide talking about waste and pollution, and we've been talking a lot about weather and natural disasters, but in terms of a more static issue, when we look at communities, for example, like North Minneapolis that has the HERC incinerator that causes pollution in the community, which is, you know, more of a community of color, low income community. When you're looking at risk and investment in communities like that versus a few years ago in Baltimore, the grassroots sort of effort actually blocked a garbage incinerator in a neighborhood of color. And so just wondering, what does it look like when you do an analysis on low-income communities or communities of color that have pollution-producing entities within it versus just like sort of a cleaner part of the state or a cleaner state without much industry, if that makes sense at all?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, I think waste and pollution, while not relevant for governments, I think it typically is something we see mostly affecting utilities, like water utilities. Like their role is to provide clean water. So, you know, going back to the materiality, we kind of always have to be looking at where the risk intersects with the materiality of our analysis. And I think to your question, in some cases, if we believe that that pollution is inordinately leading to economic constraints within the community, meaning, you know, are people not moving there because of this pollution? Are people not, are companies not coming there because, you know, they want to be in a community that, you know, is either maybe doing more to contain the pollution, or, you know, maybe, you know, there's other synergies related to economies that exist in other locations that they want to move to. I think that's where we definitely see the intersection with credit because of the constraint on the economy of the entity. Their potential inability to raise revenue to meet their budget requirements. In terms of the social issues around the vulnerable population, so this is something where I think, you know, the intersection with credit is a bit less clear. Social justice issues, and I actually spoke with the Government Finance Officers Association Debt Committee yesterday, and social justice or social issues around vulnerable population is, you know, sometimes a case-by-case basis. So we do believe that, you know, governments who prioritize sort of ensuring that vulnerable populations have access to services, have, you know, the same types of, you know, baseline expectation for government that all people do is important. And I think in some cases we've seen where social justice issues like that have affected credit, and other cases where it's potentially something we're watching because maybe the entity is allocating more resources to ensure those vulnerable populations are supported and how that sort of pans out within their budget. So, you know, I think to your point, directly an entity that has, you know, a lot of pollution associated with it can really affect the economy potentially if people don't want to live there or other entities don't want to locate there. But I think longer term, the social justice issues around vulnerable populations is something, you know, that can sort of either have an immediate effect or maybe a longer term effect on a credit rating. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Representative Byrd.
It does, actually. Thank you so much. You articulated it a little better than I was. So
okay.
Thank you.
Okay, good.
Representative Breyer, last follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With your permission, I had one other question.
Go for it.
It's about state and local credit. And it seems to me that they're, you know, I hear the differences. Are there best practices that you've seen in other states that you would recommend, the tools in the state's toolbox to help protect local credit ratings, which is in the interest of all of us?
So I think some things that we've seen, and all, I think probably the research that Peter will send to you can be helpful in that regard too. But for example, in Virginia, you know, the Hampton Roads area, which is northern Virginia primarily, is inordinately exposed to flood risk and sea level rise just because of the fact that they're right on the ocean, and there's a lot of population and economic concentration in the state in that particular area. And the state has been very instrumental in developing regional partnerships, and the entities, the local governments within that area are very active in those regional partnerships because they maintain a philosophy that if, let's say, Hampton, Virginia, which is sort of the center of that area, does some good stuff around infrastructure to contain floods and sea level rise, they might inadvertently be moving water to a neighboring community. So they have to really work together to solve that problem. So I think in some cases, those regional entities are very important. In South Florida, which is an area inordinately exposed to sea level rise, they've also have a number of climate action regional entities that help the local government set baseline assumptions for climate change, baseline assumptions for sea level rise. And they sort of all use those and integrate them into their individual practices. So from a regional perspective, they're all working together to solve the problem or the question mark, but they're also sort of working off of the same assumptions to develop infrastructure and resiliency and adaptation measures. So I think those are maybe a couple of examples, and I apologize, I'm not as familiar with Minnesota and the regional entities that might exist there in your state, but I think that those are really good good best practices that we know of.
Thank you, Ms. Westruck. And if members have any other questions, they could have. I would encourage them to follow up with you individually after this. Next up on the agenda, we have Ms. Cohen. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you to the committee. Greetings. And I appreciate that you invited me to share my thoughts with you today. I'm going to share my screen. Give me 1 second. Share. Okay. Let's get this from the start. Okay. Can everyone see the screen? Yeah?
Yes, please proceed.
Okay, great. So my name is Natalie Cohen. I'm president of National Municipal Research. I've been in the municipal industry for more than 40 years, beginning with my role in government for New York City's government at the Office of Management and Budget, later at a rating agency, numerous years in the bond insurance industry. I headed up the research group at Wells Fargo, and now I'm independent. I first want to paint the context. I'll touch on a few things that haven't been brought up yet, so I'm not duplicative. Focus on the impact on our states and local governments, and then how these impacts are connected to the capital markets, and conclude with some additional thoughts. Rather than giving you multiple handouts, I've heavily hyperlinked throughout this presentation. So hopefully they'll work for you. If they don't, just please reach out and I'll be happy to send you the information. As already been mentioned, we're experiencing much more frequent extreme climate events such as flood, fire, tornado, tsunami, earthquake, and rising sea levels. Scientists generally agree that it's a cause of some of this is carbon emissions that are tending to warm the earth and play a causal effect. To react to this, world leaders met in 2015 in Paris, and 191 countries plus the EU approved what's called the Paris Agreement, with the goal of slowing down the global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. I've provided that agreement and more information for you to look at. In 2021, there was a conference of the parties called COP26, and Moody's wrote in their report, ready or not, sector performance in a zero carbon world. And the commentary of the CEO was, few issues are poised to multiply risk or opportunity more dramatically in capital markets than climate change. And I would say this certainly applies to municipalities and states as well as companies. Central bankers have also risen to the occasion, including our US Federal Reserve, to recognize that extreme climate events do affect or can in the future affect financial stability. And as Peter mentioned, the current SEC chair is eager to see that climate-related disclosures are included in financial statements and has announced a proposed rule on that point. I just want to briefly mention what the rule is addressing, and you can, again, you can pull that up from the hyperlink. It requires disclosure about the issuer's climate-related risks and relevant risk management processes. And I mention this because it's come up a little bit in the conversation so far. I've been an advocate of a system called enterprise risk management, which essentially empowers every employee as a risk manager and brings together some of the leaders of the different agencies and departments. It is required at the federal level, and many many companies use this process. It's a high level effort to bring together all the different constituencies to identify risks that would prevent you from implementing your vision. So it's quite, it's general and it's high level. It's not just risk management in terms of buying insurance or capital planning. And I think it's a useful thought process for state and local governments to engage in with their various constituencies. And again, the SEC proposal says whether these risks have had or are likely to have a material impact on its business and consolidated financial statements. Then they go through a couple of levels, and one is to understand and disclose what are the types of greenhouse gas emissions that are related to the company. And I would insert government on this front. Is it, you know, and I'm going to talk about a couple of levels that are directly related to municipals. And I know we're going to hear from Professor after we finish these initial presentations. The second level is then indirect emissions through the purchase of energy, the type of energy systems that you use in your community and within your state. And then scope three disclosures are a little bit vaguer and more controversial, but they are asking for entities, companies, and so on to look at the vendors that they use. And that, of course, is a little bit more difficult to figure out and disclose. And as mentioned earlier, the MSRB is also beginning to look into that. So these issues are coming to a neighborhood near you. So to this point about enterprise risk management, I believe that capital spending and planning should emerge from the overall risk analysis so that it gives you an opportunity to identify where in your state are there weaknesses in the infrastructure, and it may be, again, in your lower-lying, low-income Black and African-American communities. It may be in aged infrastructure in some of the smaller communities, and some of these places may need an extra lift. That is the value of then driving into your capital planning and your bond issuance process. As mentioned earlier, many states and municipalities have developed climate action plans. And these are plans, not necessarily implementation. Implementation is equally, if not more, important. And I gave you a few links to Minnesota's plan and the EPA, and there are others out there. Right now is a good time to use bonds to strengthen and modernize infrastructure to withstand extreme climate events. There's growing demand from investors for green bonds and also for ESG, as well as ESG disclosure. We know from recent pronouncements by the central bank that interest rates will be rising over the next year or 2 years to combat inflation. And we also know that the Infrastructure Improvement Jobs Act, the funding should be flowing relatively soon. The funding in that act goes to the states, which is then up to the states to invest in local and state infrastructure improvements. I do want to add one thing that was brought up before about pollution. What we've seen in certainly in the area of floods, that improperly capped landfills or Superfund sites and so on can unfortunately be turned into a very toxic gook when you, and that's not a technical term, when you have a flooding situation. A couple of years ago, it was mentioned that Midwestern floods, which affected Minnesota as well. They happened after the harvest season, and the silos were very full with grain. And if you looked at some of the pictures, or it was in your local community, you saw the damage that was done to the harvest from the prior year. Federal policy for subsidies to farming don't tend to deal with that. This is an after the fact. And so it's important to be looking in every corner and every nook for how the what if scenario might affect your economy and your local government, that in turn might affect your fiscal picture and your credit rating. Couple of distinctions that I want to make that often get confused. There's the issue of labeling bonds, and that's different, of course, than what state and local governments are actually doing to strengthen infrastructure. And some of that may be outside of the bond market. Certainly there are low-cost improvements that are made. I know that Nora mentioned things like permeable sidewalks and roadways that can absorb some of the flood. That was a problem in Hurricane Harvey in the Houston-Harris County area. And then second of all, there's a proliferation of companies that measure, document, and monitor the greenness of bonds, and that's an evolving industry, I would say, or cottage industry. Some is proprietary, and the fund families certainly have proprietary ways of looking at the merits of a green bond. And so I would say we're early in that evolution, but just examine carefully, you know, how and what you're doing. The GFOA recently approved a best practice, the Government Finance Officers Association, in terms of the designation of bonds. They have copious best practices, and these are at the local level, although I certainly would say they can apply to states as well, and your state government groups have probably issued some of these, but there's a link to this topic. And I just want to read, because they do make the distinction between designating bonds and the actual functional perspective. It says the issuance of designated bonds, which would mean something that has a green or social label, something like that, as opposed to ESG credit risk disclosure by a government. So in other words, your past events that have occurred in your communities and what you're doing about it. So that's a different matter than actually labeling a particular bond issue. So it was also brought up that the SEC does not have direct authority to require state and local governments to disclose. However, in the past, the different disclosure requirements were handled through the broker dealers because they are governed by the SEC, and credit agencies certainly have an impact as well in terms of what they are commenting on. However, SEC does have, if there is a disaster, a heavy climate disaster, they do have the right that if there hasn't been disclosure, that they do have the right to call out a borrower. And that happened on the pension front with New Jersey in terms of pension disclosures. And the MSRB, I'm sorry, is there a question?
Representative Frankie, can you mute your device, please?
Oh, no problem.
Go ahead, Ms. Okay. Warren.
Okay, thank you. And I do suggest pulling that up because the footnotes are terrific and have even more links if you are interested in diving a little bit deeper in this. So I do want to mention the context here. The United Nations, this comes out of the UN. You've heard about the IPCC reports that are saying it's almost too late to actually lower carbon emissions and to change the progress of extreme climate, but there are some really good reports on this. And there's one specifically for the US municipal bond market. I've linked to that, but it was put together by some of the major analysts and portfolio managers of 16 large institutional investors, so you can get further insight into how investors are thinking about this. And I just mentioned a few: Nuveen, PIMCO, Wells Capital Management, Goldman Sachs, and some others. And then there's also on the Principles for Responsible Investment, there is some work that they've done on credit risk and ratings. Finally, pension plans. I was glad Peter brought this up. There is some controversy at this point about the way in which policy can govern investment allocations. I'm bringing it up in a neutral, nonpartisan way. There are some states that have laws against divestment, particularly in the area of fossil fuels, and others are encouraging greening investment portfolios and shifting into, over time, shifting into more green types of securities. I did write a piece on the effect now of the recent war in Ukraine, added to the inflation in gasoline prices, which has complicated this discussion in terms of increasing our production of fossil fuels and perhaps reversing what we've been seeing in the past. And in the interest of covering all the bases, the Heartland Institute, which leans conservatively, has been keeping track of the various anti-climate change activities here. There's a lot more to cover, but I will leave you to ask questions, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Cohen, just to clarify for me, please, does the condition of a state's infrastructure affect its credit rating?
Ms. Cohen.
Yes, I do think that. I mean, I'm not going to speak for the credit rating agencies. I don't work for one. So, but clearly analysts do, as part of their spreadsheets, they have typically an estimate of the age of the infrastructure, the level at which investment in that infrastructure has been made over the years. And clearly that's an issue that the president has been and the Congress have been attempting to address with the infrastructure improvement in terms of bridges, roads, school buildings, water sewer systems, and so on. So it certainly affects the way an analyst would look at it. It's probably more transparent at the local level where you can actually get sort of age of structures, when they were last improved, and so on, plus looking at financial statements for investment in those facilities. But certainly the states have lots of roads and highways and buildings and facilities as well. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Cohen and Mr. Chairman. One other point, you mentioned that past events in communities and how they are being dealt with can be factors. Would you explain what type of events you're talking about?
Ms. Cohen.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for that question. I think related to the items that we've each mentioned, flooding, you know, if you've had a repeated flooding situation in certain areas, and if you've had fires, you know, that's certainly been more of a Northwest and Western issue, what kind of damage, and tornadoes, you know, what kind of destruction. I do want to mention that there is, at least from what I hear at the local level, there's some complacency that FEMA will come to the rescue. And, you know, we've had some bumps with that over the last number of years. It depends upon how the Congress feels about FEMA's reach into the Treasury, because the flood insurance program overspent its appropriation and dipped into Treasury during a number of the years that there were some heavy cumulative disasters across the country. And unfortunately, the timing in terms of the flood season times with the federal budget, and there was a glitch at one point. So hopefully I've touched on an answer to your question with that.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Cohen.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the nature of this presentation as it relates to the infrastructure improvements that the testifier was talking about. So I would like to ask the testifier, knowing that we've got OSHA oversights and MN OSHA oversights, and that we have the environmental focus and safeguards here in Minnesota, is it not more environmentally responsible to focus on mining and infrastructure projects here in Minnesota that will provide good paying, safe, and environmentally conscious union jobs that will grow our economy here in Minnesota instead of relying on foreign powers like China or others where we cannot control their environmental regulation and their oversight? I'd like to hear, isn't it more responsible for us to focus here on Minnesota where we can control these environmental oversights? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh. We don't deal with mining in the Capital Investment Committee, and I'll let Ms. Cohen, you know, take a stab at that. Ms. Cohen.
Okay, a very quick stab at it. Far be it for me to represent the policymakers in the state of Minnesota and also in the Congress and around the world. I think you're raising a very good and important question. I think that we have, one of the other speakers did touch on transition risk, and I think that needs to be taken into account. I do believe that the current war in Ukraine, as I said, is turning the emphasis away a little bit from clean, you know, good paying jobs, infrastructure, and so on, into turning the spigots back on to produce more fuel locally within the United States. But we are generally self-sufficient, but I would note that some of the energy companies have moved away from new, you know, new production in light of the pressure to go more towards green and renewable resources within the United States. So this is kind of a tension that we're experiencing right now. And I would certainly urge to continue waving that flag. I personally support it, but that doesn't reflect, you know, what your co-legislators are thinking about all that.
Representative Raleigh, last follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would push back a little bit on the chair from the standpoint of I do believe that this is an issue that the Capital Investment Committee should take a look at, because the presentation that we're getting is on the global environmental impacts, and the infrastructure that we're putting into Minnesota will help with that because we've got much better controls than many other nation states that we've seen out there. So I would like to continue to ask the questions on if we're seeing what the environmental impacts are, what can we do as Minnesotans to make a better impact? And I think we can better control that than some of the foreign countries that are out there. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh. And I'm sure that Chair Hansen, who is on here, will be glad to have those conversations with you. And, you know, if you want to talk about those, we could have those conversations when the bills that I'll be bringing up to address some of these conversations come up. Thank you, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr.
Next
Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have Mr. Fabian.
Great. Thanks very much. Let me share my screen. Okay, so thanks for having me. I'm Matt Fabian, a municipal bond analyst, and I work at an independent research company, so we have no trading interest in the market. I think that what is interesting for Minnesota now is that there's a tremendous opportunity for the state to decide what to do and to actually begin to do whatever it sort of expects or believes is most important. But this isn't necessarily something or a situation that will remain in the long term. There is a lot of talk, and I'm sure that Minnesota's investment bankers and municipal advisor, and even your own bond team, would tell you that at this point, the municipal bond market in general seems to care very little about climate change. And on the surface, right, that is something that is apparently but not actually true. It's true that there is a lack of differentiation in the prices that municipal bond and other sort of adjacent lenders will charge to governments depending on how much climate risk they have directly or indirectly, and or what's their response and how their response is being shaped, right? There isn't that much differentiation now on those prices, but that's less a function of the market ignoring or not understanding as it is being the market being forced to absorb that risk. So I think that was just sort of an important distinction. And that reflects in this chart here, which I'm showing, is a basic estimate of the interest rate that a state like Minnesota, actually this is a little bit higher than what Minnesota itself would pay, probably more in tune with what its local governments would pay in order to borrow money, depending on the different maturities. The highest lines are for 30-year maturities, and the lowest lines are for 1, 2, and 3-year maturities. And this is just the trend over time. And you can see, even though this year yields have risen a fair bit because of the Fed and because of the pandemic and the war and similar and inflation related to those, yields are not that high, meaning capital costs haven't risen all that much. We're still very close to historic lows. And I'll talk about why. First is scarcity, right? There just aren't municipal bond issuers, states, local governments just haven't issued all that much debt. This is a very long-term trend since 1987 of the amount of outstanding municipal bond debt. This gray line, which is flat, basically at about $4 trillion for decades, is about, that's the outstanding amount of muni bonds. By comparison, you have the treasury line, which is quite vertical, regardless of the partisan affiliation of who's in the presidency, who's in Congress, and similar. We're at a very vertical line here, but up to $22 trillion as of the end of the fourth quarter. Now, the Fed itself owns about $5 trillion of that, but still, that's sort of the vertical nature, even U.S. corporations, much higher. So when you compare that to munis, you can see that there is just an endemic and chronic scarcity of bonds that compels investors to buy what they can, regardless of sort of their appreciation of climate risks and similar. Now, they can also do that because municipal defaults have been very low. This is a percent of all muni bonds currently in default by dollar. This line at the top here is Puerto, if you include Puerto Rico, if you exclude Puerto Rico, we're at just under 0.4% of that $4 trillion of outstanding bonds are currently in payment default. It's a very low default rate. You can see some increases here. This was Detroit, right, and things like that. But in general, very low default. And Puerto Rico, just so you know, had a big restructuring last week. So the amount of their debt that's actually in default dropped sharply. So few defaults in debt that is very scarce forces investors to take bonds regardless. Now, I just want to talk about how that is potentially likely to change, right? Because investors, like all the rest of us, right? Like no one, I don't think, in America is dumb, right? We're not ignoring this or sort of closing our eyes and not thinking about it. It's just this sort of risk appreciation that we're forced to do. Investors also, the market itself has shifted so that as opposed to individuals like your typical municipal bond investor is a dentist, right? Working with their broker to pick bonds. That is what it used to be. Today, it's more giant mutual funds who have thousands and thousands of bonds all at once. And so if they make a mistake on one or a few, it doesn't really even matter as a rounding error. This sort of strategy of, you know, risk mitigation through diversification on the investor side only works, right, to the extent that the risks that they're worried about are idiosyncratic, meaning individual at the level of the individual borrower. If they become systemic, right, if a lot of issuers begin to default or have trouble at once, those strategies could get out of hand and begin to reprice. So that's the sort of, and I don't want to say that that's the scenario that we're headed to because we don't really know. The climate science is very chilling, but how exactly it manifests into the muni bond market is difficult, in part because muni bond investors are typically at the top of the heap. States, local governments have lots of stakeholders, service recipients, employees, taxpayers, businesses, and things who are almost always in front of municipal bondholders as far as taking pain when bad things happen, right? You might lay off workers or you might cut services, but you'd be loath to default on your bonds first, right? So that's, again, why sort of we have this sort of potentially more complacent environment. But what's interesting about climate change specifically is that different than the situation with state pensions, where the data ultimately manifested from the states and local governments themselves, right? And where a lot of your financial information comes from, you know, that you disclose to investors and similar, comes from yourselves. On the climate side, it's different, and that there are things afoot that will shift the ground under the typical issuer and in effect reward proactive investment, proactive strategies now before the ground changes. Like, for example, the disclosure that is required of all bond issuers really doesn't, it addresses risks in the largest sense, meaning that if you believe that climate change presents a material risk to your bond investors, then you have to disclose it, right? That's how, that's where we are now. It doesn't matter that it's climate risk or any other kind of risk that you can think of. But issuers have done in general a fairly uneven job of disclosing anything. And so now, like today, the SEC enforcement group is considering their own innovation, looking at, for the first time, have issuers not disclosed appropriately their climate change vulnerability, or have they not done sort of a reasonable job in understanding that risk? And so it's likely, because that's typically how municipal regulation works, is sort of rulemaking through enforcement, is that it's likely, I think, by the end of this year or next year, that we'll begin to see enforcement actions by the SEC against municipal issuers for not disclosing adequately. And that will shift what municipal issuers are, you know, ultimately compelled to provide to their investors. The GFOA is working, like other speakers said, to sort of get out in front of this and to help issuers also begin to disclose better. But there's also, you know, and I think this is important, there's a lot of third party, very good third party data available now that investors are both reading and consuming, again, not necessarily using to change prices on bonds, but absorbing into their strategy. And it's up to the issuers themselves to also do the same, in part to understand your risk, and in part to understand the shifting investor appreciation of those risks. And I don't think on my next slide, I only have, I do a little bit, but not too much. So let me talk about this now. I'm gonna point you towards FEMA last year released publicly for the first time what's called their National Risk Index. And it's about climate change. And it goes down to, it's a gorgeous user interface that you can get to for free and pull up information about your state, about counties, about local governments. I think it goes down to the census tract information. And it looks at the individual physical climate perils and in each of these. And they have a list of 14 or so climate perils that they think about. And it also, and it weighs those physical climate perils at the state and local level to the community's incremental resources, right? The wealth, their ability to manage those risks, and also the community's vulnerabilities. So if it is a poor community and they have an outsized environmental risk, their risk score from FEMA will reflect that. So this is something that investors are looking at, will be using ultimately to help price your bonds. You should be looking at it too, to help shift your own policy, but also to understand where sort of the ball is moving with respect to investors. And then finally, let me just throw in some points here. In addition to the physical climate risks that people talk about, like flooding and it's too cold or it's too dry or it's too stormy, these things that like are in the headlines, there are other risks out there that are adjacent to and not necessarily small. So think about, for example, migration. You know, migration is a risk where people or companies or employers move into Minnesota or out of Minnesota because of the relative climate risks that they face, right? And that's not just risks because of the, you know, of the storms or what have you. It's risks because of the regulatory environment, right?
Mr. Fabian, can I have you wrap up? We have less than a minute left in the hearing.
Sure. And then also political risks. The issue here is of the example might be New York State, where you have New York City which is going to consume a lot of New York State's future ability to remediate climate change, that may come at the expense of upstate communities, which could see their state aid cut if New York State doesn't act proactively to understand and address those. Similarly, Minnesota should be doing something proactively, thinking about those costs to the local governments. Okay, I'll conclude. Sorry, I talked too much.
No worries. Thank you, Mr. Fabian and members. We will come back to Dr. Gray's presentation in the next hearing. Really appreciate all of our testifiers joining us from across the country to come and present on how climate risks impact our credit rating and our ability to bond for critical infrastructure projects. Members, our next meeting is Tuesday, March 29th, and this meeting is adjourned.